spring break, there's not really another opportunity to turn it in. Okay, so first off, any questions? Okay, so we're coming up to spring break here. Yes, we're all happy for it. It's a nice day. In fact.
Oh, look, we're almost at ground level.
We're not using the computer today, so we can use the light in. Let's see the construction zone. Right, so next week, basically we come back. I'll do a review Tuesday, and the midterm is on Thursday. Maybe we could get back, okay?
It will be on everything we've covered.
Basically, it will be on everything we've covered, and I will suggest to you that a good way to study is to try the exercises in the book. I will try to pick problems from the book, rewriting them as appropriate, because some of these are open-ended, so I don't want that on an exam. But I will pick questions out of the first three chapters of the book, basically. That's what will be on the exam.
Okay. Well, did you have a homework for me?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I think I would like to start by going over the homework you just turned in, since we won't really have time for it when we get back. So, anybody have trouble with number one? I hope not. We did the first part in class, and then the second part that you did, you needed those results, obviously, but then it was just a matter of doing the integral over the specified range. So for example, the fraction of stars with mass greater than five solar masses is just the integral from five to whatever your upper limit is, which is essentially infinity, divided by the integral from the lower limit, which was specified as 0.3 in this problem. The same infinite upper limit. And so if you go through that, you you get your 2.2% and so on. So xi naught is that Fishy normalization parameter. You need to be told the total number of stars, or equivalently the total mass in stars, to work that out. But once you do, you can set this equal and work those sorts of things out. Okay. So that, I mean, that kind of gives you a feel for, you know, those massive stars are rare by number. So it's about 2%, right? But they were contained 37% of the mass, because, right, you're weighting this by mass. Right, so the mass is the integral. m xi dm and so forth. So this is generically how you weight over distributions. Right, so if you have a distribution of n and you want to know some property, do the integral of that property times the distribution. Same thing for luminosity, wherever you were told that they used 3.5 there. This proportionality varies depending on the mass range of the stars you're talking about, so different numbers get used different times. I think they used 3.5 in this problem, if I remember right. I said 4 in lecture. For low mass stars, it's more like 5. Decent approximation, but it's not a single power law for every single possible kind of star. Okay. And so, obviously, these stars, these massive stars, contain all the light. And so, for young clusters like the Pleiades, that's what your eye is attracted to, those few really bright stars. And after a cluster is aged and those things have evolved away, then you're left with a lot more comparable luminosity stars. So that's what you see in a globular cluster. There's a lot of stars of the same luminosity. Generically, though, you always see the brightest things first. The first rule of selection effects. And astronomy is dominated by selection effects. You always see first the things that are easiest to see. And those are always the brightest, highest surface brightness, most concentrated, stand out very well. Okay, so number two is similar.
When you calculated the hang total, did you just basically do the integral except just with the lower mass limit there? Is that what that is?
I believe so.
Okay. And all you did was plug in the size.
So when we get a total of about 700, I got 691. So yeah, I did the integral for M total with the lower limit as specified and on up to infinity, essentially, because 1 over mu when it's big doesn't matter too much. And set that equal to 800. Right? So the result of that integral is equal to 800 solar masses. And that's just xi naught times these silly integration constants, right? The 0.35, and then the 0.3 is the lower mass limit. Now, I actually tried it because, you know, a lot of times in a saltpeter IMF, we assume that the lower mass limit is 0.1. It doesn't actually make a huge difference to the number. But that's how that's done. So getting xi naught out of 800 is just going through those silly constants because of the way Ed Saltpeter chose to define this half a century ago. Right, so xi is dndm. And that's what we got. Solution. Thank you. Right, so once you specify xi naught, then you can do the integral again and get the number. So they could have told you that there were 700 stars and asked you what the total mass was, either way. Okay, other questions? Okay, number two. So I liked this problem just because it made you think about how many stars there were in the galactic center, where the density of stars is much greater. Mathematically, it's very similar to number one. But you do have to work out crudely what your visual limit is and what stellar mass that corresponds to. So the problem gives the eyeball limit of an apparent magnitude of 5. If you go to a really dark site, the eye might see it's faint at 6th magnitude. A lot of stars in the sky when you do that. And it basically says, okay, you're living inside a cluster 3 parsecs across. How many of these stars can you see? And so the first thing is to work out the absolute magnitude that you can see. Mm-hmm. So here is where you use your distance of 3 parsecs. Now, of course, really you'd want to integrate over the distribution because it's not like you're sort of essentially assuming it's a homogeneous sphere of stars here, which is not. More importantly, that you're assuming that it has a hard edge, which it doesn't. But so this is already an approximation. And in general, you could do some sort of integral over this, just like we do for the IMF. And so for a limiting magnitude of 5th magnitude, the faintest thing you can
and C, then the absolute magnitude and the B works out to what, 7.6.
Right.
Okay. So that you can use to figure out what the corresponding stellar mass of such a star is, so that you can apply these integrals in the same way. So the luminosity corresponding to that absolute magnitude at a distance of 3 parsecs that we got from that distance of 3 parsecs is what? It's very small,
0.877.
Yeah. So yeah, it's 8% of the solar luminosity. And I was stumped briefly by this relation here until I actually read the text in the book where it says, gives alpha as 5 for stars less than one solar mass, which is of course what we're talking about. And that's why they hint to you that it should be about 0.6 solar masses. If you plug in 0.08 here and alpha is 5, you'll get the mass is 0.6 solar masses. Because
yeah,
this is very steep. Right. So say the fifth power. So that's the sort of the faintest star you can see. And it's worth thinking about, right? How many of these stars do you actually see in our sky? What's the distance to Alpha Centauri? Closest star.
3 or 4
light years.
Which is about a parsec.
It's not much more than 1 parsec, and that's the closest star. And so we're talking about being able to see this if it's 3 parsecs away. There aren't a heck of a lot of stars as close as 3 parsecs. So even though there are a lot of these stars, there are only going to be a few of them that we could actually hope to see by eye in our own skies. Right, so then it asks you the for an age of 3 giga-years, what's evolved away? Massive stars evolve away fast. So main sequence age of 3 giga-years corresponds approximately to 1.5 solar masses. So again, it's a very strong function, the main sequence lifetime, very strong function of mass. One solar mass lives 10 giga-years, 1.5, only 3. Okay. Now, if you actually look closely at what the book says, it's not consistent. Interpolating to table 1.1 would give you a slightly lower mass than this, like 1.4 or something. If you use equation 1.8 on the same page, you get something a little bigger than 1.5. So it's in there. Now that formula is just a sort of an approximate fit to the data, so it's not necessarily exact. And in detail, it depends on the metallicity as well as the mass. Only a little bit, but that's okay. Okay, so basically this specifies your mass range. They tell you the lower limit of 0.2, and this is basically the effective M up. So then you can do the same sort of integrals as you did for number one. Find then the n is the 6 xi naught for these ml and mu, and the mass is 2.5. Okay, so now why do red giants not contribute a lot to this, to the numbers here?
Mostly gone.
Well, what mass are the red giants?
Big.
Well, they're the things that have just turned off the main sequence, so they're close to M up. Okay. How many? What mass stars dominate the numbers? These or those? That's right. So there are a lot more of these than there are red giants. Red giants are basically a narrow slice. DM of the entire IMF, and they don't live very long, so they're just that basically that narrow mass range, 1.5 to 1.6 or something, that are currently in a phase, and everything else is dead already. So there aren't that many giants. But you will see them. They're really bright, right? Their absolute magnitude is much, much higher than this. So they'll be huge balls of fire in your sky. Well, not like the sun, but they'll be really bright stars. Okay, very impressive to look at from where you're standing. And so you do these integrals for the given mass. The mass of the cluster at the center of the galaxy is known reasonably well to be about 10 to the 7 solar masses. So these are real numbers. And that gives you something on order of 4 million stars that you can actually see in this volume. Okay. That's about 1,000 times more than you can see from a decently dark sky on the Earth, because we live far out in the galaxy where stars are not so close together. Okay. That's roughly the difference between what you can see from the city here and going out in the country where it's really dark.
New Hampshire.
Okay. So, you know, basically for every one star you can see in a really dark place here, you'd see 1,000. So it's worth imagining what that would be like. And, you know, these low mass stars, you'll see lots and lots and lots of these low mass stars, but they'll be faint, they'll be down there. And then the red giants, there are a few of them, but they'll be really bright. You could probably be by the light of all of them. Stars in the sky. In fact, I'm pretty sure you could. That'd be a good problem to work out. Okay, so I just wanted to make you think about that. I know some of these problems are a struggle, but that's because I'm trying to make you think. Number 3 does not do that. You just use the definitions of A and B to work out that A plus B is the minus gradient of the rotation curve. A minus B is the angular frequency, just V naught over R naught. Nothing magical about that. If you work through the numbers for the stated 1985 IAU values of the Milky Way, V naught is 220 and R naught is 8.5, then that gives you an angular frequency of about 26 kilometers per second per kiloparsec. And that is noticeably lower than the Sagittarius A star proper motions that have been measured more recently, up around 30 kilometers a second per kiloparsec. So either V naught, if we believe that, take that as preferable, then either V naught is bigger or R naught is smaller by whatever the ratio of 30 to 26 is. Not a huge factor to be off, but it makes a difference. And then for the actual values of A and B, you have to keep straight all the signs and so forth. The absolute value of A is a little bigger than that of B, so that means the rotation curve gradient is negative. That means it's a falling rotation curve. And they say, is that a big deal if it's flat? Well, I'd say that is pretty darn flat. Numerically, it comes out to about 2.5 kilometers per second per kiloparsec if the rotation curve is falling in the solar neighborhood, whereas the amplitude is up over 200 kilometers a second. So that's a 1% rate of decline over a kiloparsec, and the galaxy is only maybe 20 kiloparsecs in radius. So that's pretty darn flat. Now, you know, there can be real variations in that. So if we were living a bit further out, maybe we're living at a place where it just happens to dip down and it dips back up. So things do fluctuate on the order of 10 kilometers a second. And those are real, so we might actually be seeing that. But in astronomy, you always have to be wary of systematic effects. A and especially B are hard to measure, and you're always afflicted by some kind of systematic error. It may depend on how far out you probe. That should be true if there are real bumps and wiggles in the rotation curve. Right? If it's going up and down and you look very locally, you'll just see some small thing, but you'll average over more of the bumps and wiggles if you look further out. That'll depend on the tracer you're using, how far away you can the tracer. You might have real differences between A stars and M stars, something like that. If that's true, those differences are real, then it's telling you something about the potential
but it first thing you have to worry about is always the systematic errors. Okay, so clusters. This is supposed to be easy. I gave you the data on a silver platter. Huh. Maybe a pewter platter. But this is something, if you go on in the field, that you'll definitely want to be able to do, to take big data sets and do useful things with them, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey being an extreme example of that. But there are lots of other data sets out there, and they're growing all the time, both in size, number, and quality. So this is something worth doing. How did my plot come out in black and white? Yeah, okay. So basically, plotting declination against right ascension. Open clusters make it sort of a sine curve, like so.
Mm-hmm. Look right to you?
Yes.
Is there an easy way to import the data into like a program like other than Excel? Because I mean, Excel made it pretty easy, but I know you told us this data.
Well, I want you to learn to do exactly this. So what solution you come up with, I don't care about.
Okay.
If Excel worked for you in this case, okay. But in general, that's my point about if you go on, you're going to want to be able to do this data handling. And at some point, you really want to write your own codes that can go in and say, I want this piece. Okay. So I wanted it to be a little challenging to import the data. I mean, the data are all there.
Yeah,
right? But yeah, this is a problem that we run into a lot. And so
is there like a simple way to import it from like MATLAB or something?
For MATLAB, I don't know. I don't use it myself.
Okay.
But you can, for Linux, if you use a Unix machine, there are things like cut. There's actually a command called cut, and you can tell it to cut, you know, this row, or these columns, stuff like that, and then export that to another file. So, yeah. Yes?
There is an easy way in MATLAB. There's like a, I don't remember what the function is called. You have to Google it, sorry, but there is a function that, like, you can tell it which rows to read, which columns, everything. But I don't remember what it's called.
So
Yeah,
I mean, these are the sorts of tools you want to master. And so that is one reason I make you do this. So why do we have this funny shape here? That's right. So the RA in DEC is defined, right? Delta equals zero, that's the celestial equator. That's basically defined by the Earth's orientation, right? And this Milky Way doesn't need to obey that. If it happened to be aligned, then it would be a straight line across here, delta equals zero. But in general, it doesn't have to be. And in fact, it's tipped. And if you look at the numbers, the declination goes to about 62 as alpha goes to zero. And that's just the orientation. That's the quantitatively the tip of things. So basically, if this is the Milky Way, and the solar system is going along that way. And it's tipped about 60 degrees.
But why do you have two arms like that? I have trouble visualizing the I mean, you can see it being one side of that, but why is it double?
Because it's the Milky Way is all around the sky. We're in the plane of the Milky Way. You're plotting the entire sky here from 0 hours up to 24.
Yeah.
It wraps around. So you have to wrap this thing around your head. So imagine doing that. Since we're embedded in the Milky Way itself actually extends over our head and all the way around the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's just the projection of that band into a coordinate system that has its zero here. Okay, so it's a sine curve. Complete sine curve. And, you know, depending on what that tip is, you know, if it were a modest tip, it'd be something like that.
Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to see a computer cartoon of this or something, you know? I still have a little trouble with that. Going from Earth-based to galactic.
I can't do that on the board.
So what do the globular clusters tell you?
Pashas.
Where the centers are.
Yeah, so these actually have a defined center. The open clusters are all over the plane, but they're not telling you where the center is. There's no clear concentration. Mm-hmm. And that's because of dust, basically. If you could see through the galaxy, then presumably the density of clusters would increase towards the center. Okay. But you know, you can't really do that.
Looks like it's about 17 or 18, maybe.
So there's a huge concentration of globulars in the constellation of Sagittarius.
And roughly that's at about 18 hours, minus 25 declination.
Very good.
Minus 25 means it is in the southern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so actually looking for such an animation with Google, I found something that looked like this, but not an actual animation. I ran across somebody who was having the same kind of conceptual headache. It's like, well, but that can't be right. It only, you know... We only see half the sky, and you know, the Milky Way would be different in the southern hemisphere. It is. The Milky Way is more impressive in the southern hemisphere. There are more bright stars there because the galactic center is down there.
Hmm.
Now, we're not at the North Pole, so we do get to see this sometimes, but it's low on the southern horizon. So, yeah.
I had just a general question. So with I noticed there's like a spot where it kind of seemed like the amount of open clusters, it's like where the first dip was kind of decreased. So it could, that corresponds to like where it would be behind us. Is that why?
For the open clusters or for the
globular? For the open clusters.
Yeah, there are sort of
80.
Yeah, there are pinches in it. So one thing you can notice is there is a thinning of globular clusters in the anti-center direction. So 180 degrees in phase away from the globular cluster centroid.
Mm-hmm, slightly.
So that thinning up there is because now you're looking away from the galactic center, so you are running out of stars of open clusters, because you're actually looking more out of the galaxy that way. And of course, you're looking out of the plane of the galaxy perpendicular to that. So there is more information in there than just the plane, but it's not easy to extract because of dust. So there's another pinch, at about declination zero, so around about here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is close to the center of the Milky Way, where there's a little bit of a decrease in the number of open clusters. I think that's a dust effect.
Dust effect.
There's a lot of dust towards the galactic center. So, it makes it hard to see things.
Do you have a website that for that visualization on this, on the open cluster thing?
I might still have it up on my browser. I'll let you know if I do.
I'd like to see that.
You know, it's a pretty version of that picture.
Okay.
Right, so any other questions about that? Okay, so now number five. How many of you started this before midnight? Okay, good. I was in the office till 9:30 last night, and I had only gotten one question about this problem before by then, and I was surprised by that.
A is okay.
Did anybody feel they had gotten it? Did anybody feel they got it? Okay.
The beep part.
We got
A was a giveaway.
Yes,
A was
easy. Okay, so let's get through this.
I like A.
Well, A doesn't make you think, but you need the result of A to do the rest of the problem. Okay. So, just unit conversions to work out that there are 206,265 arc seconds in one radian.
That's a number that we use a lot in astronomy because we measure things in arc seconds, smallish things, but of course the relation between the angle you measure and the physical size of something is its physical size over the distance, right? So this natural units here are radians. So you need to know this number to convert. But there's something else we covered earlier where that number should sound familiar to you. Ring a bell? What was the definition of a parsec? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, one parsec is the
angle
distance when the parallax is one arc second. By definition. Okay. So that means that a parsec is 206,265 AU by definition. Okay. And that's what you need to work out the areas here. So basically, the surface brightness by definition is the luminosity over the area of something. And that area cancels out. Don't really need to know it. So make the grad students prove that. Ask you to prove it. We start with this, right? We can, by analogy, do the same for surface brightness. I'm going to normalize it to some solar value, which I hint to you should be one sun per square parsec, because you can then relate that to how many magnitudes there are per square arc second with that number. So, now, A is the area of whatever your object covers, but A solar is going to, we're going to use that as our 0.1 sun per square parsec. And so this we can rewrite as 5 log times the size of something, where we take that to be the 1 parsec for the 1 sun. Right, so the units of sigma here solar luminosities per square parsec. And when you turn that into magnitude units, the mu is there, then it's going to come out in magnitudes per square arc second. And the symbol for that is a box. Though nowadays, mostly people write it out anyway. Seconds and minus units, whatever. Okay, so
where did you get the mu minus mu naught relationship?
Just by analogy here, I divided both sides by the area.
Both sides by the area.
This is sigma is L over A, you got L here, sigma there, so you just divided the areas out. And so if you have a magnitude spread over some area, that's the surface brightness.
Okay.
And this may seem very obscure, but it's important because this is what we actually measure for galaxies. Galaxies are not point sources like stars where you just measure a magnitude. You're measuring the light spread over some area. Okay. So it's not just a magnitude. It's a magnitude spread over some area. And this is an important point because when people first started doing photometry on galaxies, they pretended that galaxies were point sources because that's what they were doing with stars, and you make a lot of bad mistakes by doing that. For example, you don't necessarily integrate up all the luminosity if you just stop integrating when it's convenient observationally and just not worry about what is fainter than some limiting surface brightness. It's not the same, it's just an ordinary limiting magnitude. To give a very practical example of this, the sky right now is bright because the sun's up. You can't see any stars. Right? That's a surface brightness effect. The sun goes down, the sky gets dark, you can see all the stars. Right? Same thing goes for galaxies. Galaxies are spread out on the sky. They have some physical size that corresponds to some solid angle on the sky. And so how visible they are depends on the brightness of the sky. And it turns out that the highest surface brightness galaxies are comparable or only a bit brighter than the darkness of the darkest night sky here on Earth.
Surface brightness.
So if there is a population of lower surface brightness galaxies, they're very hard to see. So this is another selection effect. You always see the biggest, brightest things. All right, so basically in doing this, the trick is to realize that you need that number here. This is absolute magnitude, so it's 206.265. That's the conversion between arc seconds and parsecs, essentially, in this. And then since absolute magnitude comes in here, you have your 10 from 5 log d plus 5. That's just the absolute, the definition of the absolute magnitude, stupid as it is. And this piece of it comes out to 21.5 seconds. Thank you, magnitude system. Okay, so that piece, though, is invariant. Okay. So there are two pieces to this. This is just the conversion of this silly number that gives you magnitudes per square arc second. If you'd done it in terms of steridians, you wouldn't have this. Also wouldn't know. There aren't no sources on the sky that are a steridian across. so that would be fairly useless. And then there's a band pass dependent part depending on the solar absolute magnitude, because we're relating it to how many solar masses per square parsec. Okay. So this now tells you what the number of magnitudes per square arc second is when this physical unit is solar luminosities per square parsec.
So those are absolute magnitudes per square.
Doesn't matter. They're apparent magnitudes, but the distance drops out of this. Okay. You know that I didn't ask you to. That's the hard part of this problem, which I didn't ask you to do. We can actually show when you do this conversion that the areas cancel out. It doesn't depend on distance. And the reason for that is that you imagine a source that has some finite physical size. As you move it further away, it's going to subtend a smaller angle on the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It'll still have the same amount of luminosity. Okay. So the amount of flux that you get from that object in sum is going to go down as the distance goes down by the inverse square law.
Right.
Right. But the area it subtends is going to go down by the inverse square law. So those two effects cancel out.
So it attracts.
And the surface brightness is distance independent.
Huh.
Okay, as another reason it's handy to measure.
Who would have thought?
Now that's true in the local universe, that's true for Euclidean geometry, which is a good approximation of the universe locally, you know, out to tens of megaparsecs or so. Beyond that, Einstein tells us that the geometry of the universe is non-Euclidean, actually obeys something called the Roberts and Walker metric, and then there are redshift-dependent effects that do make surface brightness dim rather strongly, but that's because the geometry no longer obeys the inverse square law. So just
so as long as Euclid is a good approximation to the geometry, surface brightness is distance independent.
Okay, so that, I hope, was the hardest part. Could people do the integral in part C?
Didn't get to that.
Didn't get that far. Okay. So, my solutions seem to have missed out a page. Okay, well, that's a problem with trusting a photocopier at 9:30 at night. You're really not ready to check every single one. All right, well, let's go through it. So you're given the exponential disk. Is that formula? Was the first part to convert it to magnitude units? Okay, so we just worked out what that was. Well, some constant, which numerically, it just worked out. V band is 27.05. Right, U equals minus 2.5 times the log of this thing. Base 10 log, and here's our natural logarithm base. And then by the properties of log, the exponent just comes down, so the minus r over rd comes out in front, changes the negative sign. Okay. That thing is the central surface brightness. Right? Sigma naught is the surface brightness in linear units, and so this thing plus whatever constant for whatever band you're working in, that's the central surface brightness. So if we plot sigma of r, it's an exponential. If we plot magnitude of r, taking the log, basically this, instead of a linear plot, becomes a log plot, becomes a straight line with mu naught as the y-intercept. And the slope of this line is minus 1 over r d, the scale length, the e-folding size of the galaxy. Okay. And again, this is important because historically what people have done is they've been able to measure down to some limiting surface brightness, and so they would just say, okay, that's the size of the galaxy, the diameter. If you look at the RC3, the one of the famous galaxy catalogs, then they're always quoting the diameter of a galaxy or the radius at R25, that's at the 25th magnitude per square arc second level. Okay, if you have galaxies of the same surface brightness, then this galaxy has a bigger R25 than that one because it's physically bigger. But if you have a galaxy that's lower surface brightness but the same exponential scale length, it looks smaller in terms of R25, but it's not. It's got the same e-folding size. Okay, the stars are just as extended. It's just they start out more diffuse to begin with. Okay. So that's what you need to know about these things. So the product, if you work out these numbers, this is where the stupid 1.086 comes from. And so. Mm. basically the equation here by fitting a line in magnitudes per arc second versus radius. You can just fit a line and get what sigma naught, nor naught are. And so for what you observe is instead of radius, the angle theta. Theta, of course, is just r over d. And so you can imagine some scale length on the sky. And so alpha is the observed scale length. Usually measured in arc seconds. You could choose whatever angular units are appropriate to you, but that's usually the appropriate choice. But because of this relation, these things cancel out. Basically, your angle is just proportional to your physical radius. Distance drops out, so there's some angular scale length that corresponds to the physical length scale length. Okay. So then integrate to get the luminosity to some radius, some number of scale lengths. Some radius equals some number of scale lengths. X. Okay. So the luminosity is basically the integral over of the surface brightness over the area, right?
Yeah.
Circle is RDRD. Okay. Circular, polar coordinates. Okay. Element of integration. So by construction, we're assuming the beast is azimuthally symmetric. That is, it doesn't have spiral arms like real galaxies. It's just the azimuthally averaged profile. So that piece comes out easily. Pi. Sigma naught is a constant, but still you're left over with the integral from zero to some number of scale lengths. Now this thing you have to integrate by parts. Why I wrote it down last night. Sorry, which way?
Shouldn't U, D, R, and then D, V would be...
Yeah, that sounds good. Because then D, U is D, R, so D, V... Yes, absolutely. Because then this just integrates to itself.
The integral would be,
So then you have to do these pieces and evaluate them at each ends. So
wouldn't the integral be negative RD because you job center factor?
Oh, it's not. Oh, 1 over, I'm so used to doing the IMF. Yep, thank you. All right, so UV. VDU. Da, da, da.
this becomes a plus, the RD can come outside. Okay. So this just becomes RD squared, the same thing. So evaluating this at the top, it's minus XRD times RD. So when you rationalize all of that, the luminosity enclosed with some number of scale lengths, x, one minus the r squared outside, so it's x.
Shouldn't it just be E naught and then RD squared?
This all comes out. Why not sigma naught outside? I've done this so many times. RD squared comes out. Sorry. Put the squared in the wrong place. So then what have we got left over? We've got an X. E to the minus x minus e to the minus x plus 1. That's right. 1. Let's see, 1 minus x. Does that look right?
I think that's a plus.
Could
plus
be.
X.
Yes, yes it is. So that basically tells you how much luminosity there is. God.
It's unbelievable.
So this is an easy integral. Even I could do it last night and again here today with only a tiny bit of help.
I don't integrate anymore, right? This is a young person's thing. This is easy.
If you want hard, then we can talk about the de Vaucouleurs profile, which is e to the minus x to the 1/4. That's appropriate for elliptical galaxies. So L of x looks something like this. The total luminosity is just 2 pi sigma naught RD squared. This quantity, as x goes to infinity, this quantity in brackets goes to unity. Okay. That's good. Right? It integrates up to a finite total luminosity. So if you look at the equation, it's not obvious that this will do. This just continues to go on forever. So formally, these disks are infinite in size. They never end. But for all practical purposes, they do, because the thing falls off exponentially, so it integrates up to a finite thing. Now, of course, in reality, a disk isn't going to extend to infinity. Now, some star 100 megaparsecs away doesn't happen to be the tail end of our disk. Right? So this is just a convenient mathematical approximation. So not the real answer of the galaxy, just an approximation. So if you want to know what the half-light radius is,
how many scale lengths you go out to that. Well, this is often called the effective radius, so it's the first crude approximation beyond the total luminosity that you can say about a galaxy. Galaxies are not point sources, so you need at least a total luminosity and some kind of characteristic size to describe them. Big, small, whatever, can pack the same luminosity into different sizes in principle. And so the effective radius is that first attempt to do that, just the radius that contains half the light. So formally that is pi sigma naught RD squared, but what you really want to know is when this quantity equals 1/2, what x do you have to choose for that to be? That's transcendental, you can't solve it, right? That's what you're trying to solve. You can't solve that algebraically, so you just have to do it by trial and error. And it comes out to 1.7, roughly speaking, number of scale lengths.
So that means you got half the...
Half the light is inside of two scale lengths, exactly. So, you know, it's an exponential. It's very centrally concentrated. Most of the light is inside of that 1.7 scale length. The sun resides at 3 scale lengths, roughly speaking. So we are sort of in the suburbs, pretty far out from most of the mass. Now, the scale length of our galaxy is something that's hard to measure because we're in it, so exactly how far out is hard to say. But it's of that order. So certainly when you get out to 3 or 4 scale lengths, you've incorporated most of the light. I think 4 scale lengths has 95% of the light, 3, 90%, something like that. If you like solving in transcendental equations, you can put in whatever fraction you like to work out the corresponding scale. But that's, again, important going back to selection effects here, right? I gave this example of a lower surface brightness galaxy that was still big. You integrate up the luminosity. Let me make it very clear what I'm talking about. This is an important point. So let's imagine two galaxies of the same scale length. Or observationally the same alpha. But different surface brightness. Right, so that's what I've illustrated there. Now typically, when you take some image, it has some depth that allows you to measure things down to some limiting surface brightness. Okay. So historically, what people did at first, they say, okay, how bright is this galaxy? And they would just integrate up the light that they could see above their limiting surface brightness. Okay. And for the bright galaxies, that's fine, because you see it out 4, 5 scale lengths, that's way over 90% of the light, so you basically got it all. But for this guy, which is just as big, lower luminosity, right? So by stipulation here, the scale length is the same, but the surface brightness is lower. So the total luminosity is physically lower, but you're seeing a smaller fraction of it when you do this because you measure out to fewer scale lengths. And there's nothing to prevent, you know, galaxies that are lower and lower surface brightness. So you can miss some galaxies entirely if they're very diffuse, and we have discovered galaxies that are like that. And the most diffuse ones we only know about because they're so close to us that we can see individual stars and resolve them that way. So historically, this has been a huge selection effect. And we don't know how many of those galaxies there are further away from us, because at some point they just disappear entirely. But there's also a more subtle effect that if you're trying to measure the luminosity function or something,
you're only getting a small fraction of the total luminosity of the things that are near the edge of your selection limit. And so you make a serious systematic error underestimating their luminosity. Now that by itself might not be too bad, but if these galaxies are very faint on average, which this would imply probably is true, then what happens? So remember when we talked about the galaxy luminosity function? Number of galaxies of a given luminosity per cubic megaparsec, whatever. Well, okay, what you actually observe is a distribution something like this. This is the number, and the number is always dominated by the bright things. Because you see them far away, and then you have to correct for the volume. So you get this 3/2 correction, basically, for the fact that you're fighting against the flux limit, right? How bright something is decreases as the inverse squared. The volume goes up as the cube of the volume. And so you see a lot of the bright things far away, and you only see a few faint things that happen to be close to you. Okay. So you need to make a volume correction for that, and that typically comes up to be something like that. Okay, but there are only a few of these things actually in your survey. If they're like this, and you should have had a luminosity like that, you put it in the wrong bin. So a galaxy that should have been here ends up over here. Okay. And then you apply a whopping huge volume correction to it. Well, that volume correction was right, because it's based on your selection limit. But the luminosity was wrong. It should have been applied up here. And so you can get systematic errors in your luminosity function from just a small fraction of systematic errors in your measurements. So that has historically been a huge problem. And one of the things that people worry about is what that faint end slope of the luminosity function is. And it's still hard to really convince ourselves we've measured it right. Okay. Questions? All right. Well, I'm glad I prepared a lecture on dynamical time scales. it seems unwise to launch into that with 7 minutes of class time left. I'm reluctant to let you go entirely with that much time left. But I don't think I can sensibly get through anything, so I guess we'll call it that and have a good spring break.